Whether it was owing to the action of the heavenly bodies, or whether, because of our iniquities, it was visited upon us mortals for our correction by the righteous anger of God, this pestilence, which had started some years earlier in the Orient, where it had robbed countless people of their lives, moved without pause from one region to the next until it spread tragically into the West. It was proof against all human providence and remedies, such as the appointment of officials to the task of ridding the city of a much refuse, the banning of 6 visitors from outside, and a good number of sanitary ordinances. Equally unavailing were the humble petitions offered to the Lord by pious souls, not once, but countless times, whether in the course of processions or otherwise. As the said year turned to spring, the plague began quite prodigiously to display its harrowing effects. No physician's prescriptions, no medicine seemed of the slightest benefit as a cure for this disease. In addition to those trained in medicine, the number of men and women who claimed to be physicians without having studied the subject at all grew immensely. However, whether it was the nature of the malady would not permit it, or because doctors were unable to discover its origins, therefore could not apply the proper remedy, not only did few people recover, but indeed nearly all the sick would succumb within 3 days of the above-mentioned symptoms. Some died sooner, some later, and the majority with no fever, nothing. And the plague gathered strength as it was transmitted from the sick to the healthy, through normal intercourse, just as a fire catches to a dry or greasy object placed too close to it. Nor did the trouble stop there. Now, with our city in such a sorry state, the laws of God and men had lost their authority, and fallen into disrespect in the absence of the magistrates to see them enforced, for they, like everyone else, had either succumbed to the plague, or lay sick, or else had been deprived of their minions to the point where they were powerless. This left everyone free to do precisely as he pleased. There were many others who adhered to a middle way between these two, neither following the frugal regimen of the first group, nor letting themselves go in the drunken, dissolute lifestyle of the second. They partook of their fill, but no more, and instead of shutting themselves away, they would go about holding flowers to their noses or fragrant herbs or spices of various kinds in the belief that such aromas work wonders for the brain, the seat of health, for the atmosphere was charged with the stench of corpses. It reeked of sickness and medication. Others there were who were totally ruthless and no doubt chose the safest option. There was, in their view, no remedy to equal that of giving the plague a very wide berth. On this premise, any number of men and women deserted their city, and with it their homes and neighborhoods, their families and possessions, heedless of anything but their own skins, and made for other people's houses or for their country estates, at any rate, as though the wrath of God, in visiting the plague upon men to punish their iniquity, was never going to reach out where they were, as though it was meant to harry only those remaining within their city walls. As though not a soul was destined to remain alive in the city, as though its last hour had come. Hello and welcome. I'm Douglas Bowles, and this is 42 Minutes, a podcast about meaning from SyncBook Radio and distributed by thesyncbook.com. You can find us at 42 Minutes, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. You can also follow our tweets at Sync42 and at SyncBook. It's May 1st, International Workers' Day, and May Day, today the 42 Minutes Seasonal Book Club has been canceled. Well, that is, we really couldn't come to a decision as a group on what to read. And then we didn't even know if we wanted to read this spring. So I guess we're calling this one Dealer's Choice. Nonetheless, I still wanted to take this opportunity to talk about what I've been reading this spring. Tonight, I'll do so with Snorr. If you recall, our last conversation, the Winter Book Club on House of Leaves, was recorded on Leap Day, February 29th, 2020. And what I've found is these podcasts have become strange quarantine journals. Hope you've all been doing okay. How are you doing, Znor?
Good. I'm a bit bogged down. I've got to start my job again in about a week, and it's all going to be online, so I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah, we've done that in my house. Or, yeah, I've been there mentally. Yeah, so I don't envy you. Good luck.
Yeah, it just seems, I don't know, it seems pretty pointless actually. But I guess I have to do something, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah.
Make the appearance of things being productive.
Right, exactly. So, speaking of productive, so I wanted to say that I like the book club because it offers a lens to look at things through. I like having a lens.
Mm-hmm.
And we often play, synchronicity enters into it. So the books are talking to themselves over time, but then also somehow they're interacting with our current moment too.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that being said, I don't know if the rest of the, it feels like the group is starting to, you know, it comes and goes and people are interested and they're not interested. And so I definitely was at the beginning of this reading the Decameron.
Mm-hmm.
Which was interesting, and you know, I would talk about it and share it, but then I ended up back in the House of Leaves, and I would talk about that and share that too. But so that being said, I'm just thinking about in terms of if we wanted to try and do like a larger group spring conversation, it seems like we could probably get Alex to join in if, you know, we figured out when he was around. I think, like he said last time, he must be delivering pizzas and getting home later than, you know, so like he's kind of a late night guy now.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dennis, I don't know, because it seems like Dennis is interested in what he's interested in. So like that's the thing I wanted to share, is that for whatever reason, like a semester or a school, like the choosing one book for the season really focuses, like it points me at something that I can just sink my teeth into for a period of time.
Sure.
And I really enjoy that. So I'm itching to pick a book and get started into the next one, but I just don't know if the interest is waning, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, me too. The Tunnel seems great. Like that seems like a good choice. I'm willing to read that one. But yeah, it would be better if we could get more people on with it, you know.
So yeah, like, and I'm trying to make choices based on like inclusion, you know, like trying to get more people, like things that are not going to alienate people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like, you know, what's a choice that would activate lots of people instead of, I mean, although I really like where we've been landing.
Yeah, me too. I like you said, it's, I've enjoyed this whole process of these different books who already have a connection between them, like the authors have connections between them, and that's part of why we chose them. But it's been really interesting just to see how they connect up. And it feels like, as you said, we're creating this kind of, I don't know, like a meta text, like the whole book club podcast thing is kind of creating this meta text for all these different books that we've chosen kind of speak to each other. So I think that's really interesting.
Well, and that was the thing, that if we would have landed on the Decameron, we would have found that it was, you know, part of the Western canon that influenced, like you could tell that Shakespeare was in there stealing things, and that it influenced Chaucer, and it influenced Cervantes. I didn't read the whole thing, but it was interesting because it also, for my own little moment, it definitely, it's kind of like this, the sexist male author who says that he cares about women, but then also, you know, it's slightly frat boyish and rapey at the same time.
The Decameron is like that?
Yeah, the Decameron is nothing but just sex. It is sex, sex, sex. And it starts out, they're all like, you know, so it's the Black Plague, right? And these young nobles go off into the country to get away from the plague. And when they get there, they decide to tell stories. And there's 10 of them, 7 ladies and 3 guys. And they start out and they're all very prim and proper, and then one of the guys like tells kind of a blue off, you know, it's a kind of a raunchy story, and they're like, oh my, you know, but then every story after that gets more and more raunchy. I mean, it's really interesting because it's a different worldview that we can't fathom after the Reformation, I think. Because it's just in that moment where everyone's dying, it's just, you could tell that the mores have changed. People are willing to party all night and, you know, go crazy.
Yeah, there's a series of movies by Pasolini, the Italian director. It's called The Trilogy of Life. And so there are three movies. He did one for the Canterbury Tales, one for Arabian Nights, and one for the Decameron. And they're all supposed to be like that, like sex and nudity and slapstick and craziness. Like, I haven't seen any of them yet, but I'd like to. That'd be something if we wanted to. Might be easier just to talk about movies or something related to the text. Like, somebody could read the text and then we could watch the series of movies. But apparently they're all pretty raunchy.
Yeah.
Pasolini is anyways.
But then, yeah. I mean, it was interesting because it plays with this idea of Johnny Truant. Too, as far as like his, like, so it's funny, like I had planned on when we if we had a talk to, you know, apologize publicly apologize to Mark Danielewski, to say I'm sorry that I didn't believe that this was literature, that I only stated that it was art.
Yeah, I told you I made contact with this group on Facebook. That is really into House of Leaves, and I guess Danielewski in general. But I've been doing messages back and forth with one of the guys, I think, who started it out, and he's met Mark. So maybe I could ask him one day if Mark will come on to your show. I don't know if he would.
I kind of doubt it. But so, like, it is
you
very.
You could apologize to him in person. Yeah.
But I still wonder. There, it really is precise, and so, like, the things that I was most angry about conveyed the structure of what he was putting. You know, so like this, the frustration that the people are feeling with this house, or, you know, Johnny Truant's feeling with Zampano's work. Like, I was feeling that same frustration. It's like I was experiencing the labyrinth as they were experiencing it. And so, like, it succeeded on that level as a work of literature. And that when you're in the labyrinth, thinking, you know, when you're just on the ride, you don't have the context to stand back and like this. When I ended up just like going back on that last ride on the 10 speed and starting there and then ending up looping back around. I didn't read Pelafinia's letters, but
you read them before, though, you said.
I did. And so there was a lot of things that I caught the second time around, and like Infinite Jest, how it loops around, this one really does.
So you read the whole thing up to the appendices at the back?
No, I got into it. So whatever chapter that is, wait, his last ride, his Star Child ride.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I did that. And then I think Johnny Truant is after that, I went around and then I made it to about chapter 11 and then stopped again. I'm done. I gotta get out of the house. But at the beginning, there are things like there was portions that I did not understand because he's being so vague. And you can tell that, oh, this is referring to the strange thing at the end where this woman is talking to the dying baby that's on life support or something, and it's almost, pointing that maybe this is Johnny's twin or something that died at birth or something. There's more twins in that book. There's more in there, like you were saying, that... if you are willing to go, it's very precise and you're going to find more.
Yeah, I think so. Just the fact that he took 10 years to make it, I think it's intricately structured. He constructed in a way that includes so many different ideas, and he's really trying to do what you said last time, is to create this complete work of art.
There's something, the line that haunts me, I think, is that the one that Zampano says in the bits in the appendix where he's saying, I should create this character that fully interrogates himself, right? He's talking 9 months before Johnny's born, which... makes the whole thing just really strange because you don't know who's writing who at that point then. But since then I read this book called In the Land of Men, which was this woman's memoir who was David Foster Wallace's secret girlfriend. And it's so weird how it reminded me, like, David Foster Wallace ends up becoming this Johnny Truant person in my mind, having done these things at the same time, you know, fully interrogating himself but being super vulnerable and then putting himself completely on the page.
Yeah, I think they probably both were like that, like MZD as well, like he... Definitely Johnny Truant that's a part of his personality too.
But the second time through, like, you really, I guess you notice how precise the interruptions are and how structured it is, but then at the same time, like, this objectification of women and his whole relationship to women really is kind of striking, and I wonder if that's more a product of the time, you know, it was a different time in the 90s than now. Me too.
He couldn't, I don't know if he'd want to get away with that stuff now, like if he was writing that book now, but even in The House of Leaves, do you remember that part where it's talking about Ludes? And that's a guy we didn't talk about last time when we had our recording.
You were suggesting that maybe Lude wasn't real.
Yeah, that's another thing. Like it seems almost that he's a projection of Johnny. Like, I think Johnny's a way more complex character than just this kind of like a LA delinquent womanizer type. Like he's that, but he's also this very sensitive, quiet person who's really into literature, and you get that from the Pelican poems that he writes at the end, and also what his mom says about
well,
him.
Well, I think it's interesting. Zampano criticizes those poems at some point.
Yeah. He talks about those poems too. that's such a weird thing. Like it enters into it. So it kind of seems like he's projecting. Johnny Truant is creating Lude as a projection of someone he wants to be, like this crazy party goer and womanizer and drug taker and all of this, like this completely like popular person and extroverted and all of this. And so a lot of the exploits that he's saying Lude has gotten into and maybe he's gotten into, I don't know if they're real or not, or just something he wants to project that part of him for some reason. And maybe that's just to get away from the image that his mother placed on him of this kind of sensitive, like intellectual, like reading through the dictionary and reading through Shakespeare and all of this, right? Which we know he was like that because from the Pelican poems and also from Daniel Esky's own story of him himself traveling in Europe, the same thing, I think, even with the Pelican pen. And he only had he had the tragedies of Shakespeare and the King James version of the Bible. You know, it's a projection of what he wanted to be in a certain way, like this idea of this totally masculine, hypersexual kind of attractive dude. You know, so it's hard to say. But then I was just going to say, like, there's that whole section we also didn't talk about. It's almost like a page in length where it's talking about all the women that Lude slept with during that one crazy month that they both had. And then it projects into the future, and it says in a big list of all these bad things that happened to these women. And then you read that and you have complete sympathy for these women. They're no longer objects. They're like real people who are suffering and maybe suffering because of the actions of Lude and Johnny, you know? So I don't know. I think Daniel Esky is conscious of that.
I agree. As conscious as they could be. I mean, I felt the same way in Infinite Jest too, where there was just this point of view, kind of the privileged white male point of view that we just take for granted at that time, because that's the normal point of view that we're used to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether you could go back to like Philip Roth or Mailer or any of those guys. Yeah.
Yeah, of course, with David Foster Wallace and that whole generation, including Daniel Esky, I guess, unlike the previous generations of authors, at least they've got this kind of like David Foster Wallace especially, like this kind of self-critical, self-reflective side to it. He's constantly conscious of how much of an asshole he might seem like, you know. Even like you see David Foster Wallace speak, and he's always trying to humble himself, even though David, you don't have to do that, you know. Like you already seem like such a nice guy, you know. But he's constantly sort of bringing himself down, and I guess that's finally those kind of ideas help to drive him towards killing himself in the end, you know. Like same sort of thing maybe with Kurt Cobain, you know, like that idea of not wanting to be a superstar, like having it go against the entire grain of who you think you are.
Well, I think
that was kind of the attitude of the time.
Definitely. But like Dave wanted to be successful, and he wanted it's that contradiction. He wanted the celebrity, but he didn't want the cheapness of celebrity at the same time.
Yeah, I think they're really hyper conscious of that.
Well, before we read House of Leaves, I spent a lot of time in Dave's bio again. I don't know why these works are making me think about the early 90s in my own young life, and then just, you know, like how he made his way through his most troubled years and stuff. But like he was such a great writer, and he comes up with such amazing stuff, but a lot of that I think is biographical. It's the more I get into his biography, like the Oren stuff from Infinite Jest, I think is this is the self interrogation where he's making the cross and putting himself on there as far as, so that's what's so amazing is that he still was able to say, no, this is fiction. You know, I don't have a problem with drugs. I'm not an alcoholic. This isn't about me. This is stuff I picked up in Boston. So it amazes me that he was able to hide so much of himself, because you learn that like a lot of the stuff he was doing or writing about was stuff that he had done.
Yeah, I guess that just makes sense in general with authors, is that their characters, at least in part, are portions of their own personality, right? But that's interesting. It's interesting what you said about Oren. So you have Hal and Oren, and then you also have Johnny Truant and Lude. And there's some parallels there, you know? Like you can imagine Hal wanting to become more like Oren, you know? In Oren's own womanizing and kind of real extroverted kind of thinking about things, although he's strange in his own ways, right? But then Johnny Truant projecting that out for himself. It's like Johnny Truant being Hal's projection of Oren or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I don't think I would have... I mean, I was aware of this book, but I don't know that I would have... I was curious about it, but never enough to really give it a chance.
Yeah, me too. I bought it. I always thought about it. I had people recommending it to me for quite a long time. But so it was always something that I kind of had kind of far down my list. And then I actually found it the last time I went to Canada, just in a used bookstore. And so I bought it. It was really cheap. And it's just been sitting on my shelf. Like I said before, I always had this idea that it might be... it's just gimmicky. Like, it's just a guy playing at trying to be avant-garde.
Well, when Silverblatt interviewed him in 2000, that's what he said. He's saying, you know, there was a time when there were a lot of books like this, and you don't know anything about them anymore because they were just a moment in time, like a gimmick.
Huh?
I mean, but they laughed because, you know, so you could tell that he appreciated...
Who said that? Daniel Lusky said that?
No, Michael Silverblatt, when he was interviewing him, said...
And Mark laughed about that.
Yeah. Well, because he was talking about... maybe... I haven't read the guy. Roland Barthes?
Yeah.
And so he was doing similar stuff, and a lot of other people were doing similar stuff, but, you know, no one remembers any of the other people, because it was just...
Roland Barthes was doing that stuff in fiction? I know his theory stuff, but I didn't know he wrote any fiction.
Oh. I, I could be wrong. I mean, so I.
He might have like a. Let me check that. Like that'd be interesting to read his fiction if he did write some.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I studied him doing my undergrad.
I, for whatever reason, confuse him with Bartholomew, and it's just because they have B names that are pronounced strange, but they probably don't have anything to do with each other.
Oh, no, he did write some novels. Two conflicting... just wanna, yeah, A Lover's Discord, Fragments. Huh. Yeah, maybe he. That'd be interesting to read his novels. I had no idea about that.
I think so. Michael Silverblatt, the host of Bookworm, was a student of his, I think.
Well, yeah, like his famous book is Mythologies. That's his. That's the book that everybody studies in Cultural Studies 101 or something, you know.
Yeah, and I think I've actually read that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is just it's just a collection of essays, basically. But yeah, it'd be interesting if he did have some fiction. I'm not quite seeing if it is, or maybe this is. Fragments, some come from literature, some from his own philosophical thought. Yeah, I'm not sure if this is a novel either. Anyway, yeah, it'd be interesting to see what that interviewer had in mind, as like if saying a bunch of people wrote like that and then everybody's forgotten about them. I wonder what these texts are. They'd probably still be interesting.
I mean, he was intimating that maybe they weren't very good, that there was a gimmick, like you were saying, you know. So that we have, you know, just the baseline noise, cultural noise of the time that we can't really hear because we're just in the fish tank, you know, like you know, the moment is, and then you go back and you, it's like, boy, the 70s sure had an interesting sound, or the clothes sure were strange.
Yeah. Well, even like the House of Leaves is like that too. Like even the list of people who enter into it, like Camille, Paglia, and Harold Bloom, and Kubrick, and Stephen King, and all these people enter into it, and they all sort of slot into one period. Like it's definitely a 90s book, you know.
Well, that's what was so funny, because I was really rooting for the tunnel, but then I don't know. I mean, I don't know why, but this was the same, you know, in my head, the same time that I wanted to be in, so, and it really did feel like that. Like it's a 90s book through and through.
Yeah. I'm so nostalgic for the 20th century now, you know. I thought this decade would be a bit better, but it's turned out to be quite a bit worse. So as far as it is now, you know, like maybe it's going to change again. I hope it does. But you think of this century so far, like from 9/11 onward, I don't know. I guess there's always shitty things that happen in the world, but
yeah, I don't know. We veered too close to reality.
Yeah.
Well, so that was what, like, the spring choice to, in my head, was like, okay, we're gonna need an escape, but something kind of that we can use to, you know, to be in a different escapee space, you know, and be able to. So, like, that's what was interesting about the Decameron. It definitely starts in this place of, you know, it's like quarantine, and like the all the early plague stuff that he writes about. It's like, oh yeah, wow, you know. So it talks about where the plague started and how it got to Florence and what it was doing and what the symptoms were. And so it felt like all the different conversations we were having, you know, going around the table saying, this is what's happening here, this is what I'm seeing, you know. So, but then after that, like, they needed escape, and so they went off, and then they're telling, you know, the stories are all really interfacing with pleasure and like, it's the kind of Shakespearean stuff where people are able to succeed by their wit. And so, you know, a comedy of errors situations over and over and over again. But it's a lot. It's like there's a lot of stories, and you can just drop the needle and listen any old time. But to like really, like, study the stories, I don't know if I would have the headspace to do that. That's kind of how I was taking it, where the stories just start bleeding into one another.
Yeah, I really want to read that, actually. Yeah, that I have Chaucer's book, Canterbury Tales, but on my shelf, but it's in the Middle English, right?
Which
is
maybe better. I mean,
I know it's kind of daunting. Like it's pretty different than how we speak today, but you can still do it. You know, like there's a little on each page. There's a kind of translation set on the bottom, like just footnotes on the bottom that make some sort of translations for the really obscure words. But I think you could do it. Like I think if you had enough time, gave yourself the time and took some effort, you could read it pretty clearly after a little while. And it'd be fun. It'd be fun to read it like that. But yeah, so that's another one that I want to read. And then I've got Spenser too, like Spenser's The Faery Queen, which is a big one. But all these are great to read just because, like you're saying, they were so influential, and they continue to be influential through other authors, you know, even though they might not be mentioned by themselves, but they influence authors who influence authors who, and it comes right down to the present moment, all these very new books that we've been reading. So I read Ovid again, The Metamorphosis. I was reading it to my kids, so we finished the whole thing. And that's a great one too. It was fun reading that after we read The Overstory, right?
Yeah, and it would fit in anywhere in my own brain right now. Because the other thing I was thinking about was I'm just having a hankering to maybe do the Odyssey.
Yeah, that's a good one too. Yeah, I just read the Odyssey not too long ago, either in a good translation, like a good poetic translation, just one of the newer translations. I can't remember the guy's name, but that's yeah, it's great to read at any time. Metamorphosis, the one that I'm reading. It's a Penguin classic book, and it's written out in prose, so it's easier to read. I think I want to read it again in a poetic translation just to get the kind of feel of it. But you read this book, and it's apparently a huge influence on the Decameron as well, and Chaucer and Shakespeare and everybody else. You know, well, you can see it with these other authors. The Romeo and Juliet story comes from this and everything else. And it's a book, like you said, Decameron is too, like really raunchy in parts, like all this. The battle scenes are insane, like just gruesome gore described in total detail. And then there's all these parts on all this taboo sexuality. Incest of various forms and like all kinds of different homosexual or bisexual relationships and like bestiality. Everything is in this one. But there's a lot of really beautiful stuff too.
Well, so that was what was interesting about Boccaccio, is that he wrote just this one work. Like, he was like a one-hit wonder.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to figure out, he really looked up to someone who was older and more bona fide. And basically this mentor said, yeah, your stuff is really super juvenile and you probably should stop. Stop. Oh, but I can't think of what he's a famous guy from that time period.
Yeah, we should look him up just to see. It would be interesting. Let me see. Yeah, Petrarch. That's what I was thinking too. Is it Petrarch?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. I was thinking it might be him.
Yeah, and
and then Petrarch is deeply influenced by Dante. That's another link along the chain.
Yeah. And I haven't ever done the whole Divine Comedy, but I've done the Inferno, which is very good.
Yeah, I would say Paradiso is my favorite. A lot of people don't read that ever, you know, and I don't know why. And if you read Philip K. Dick, that was his favorite as well. He loved the Paradiso because it ties everything together. It's the most beautiful. It's the most just filled with light. But I can't understand people who just want to read the Inferno, you know, or even Purgatory. Like, you have to get up, you have to go through the Inferno, up the mountain, and then into the stars. Like, if you don't get into the stars, you're still stuck in the pit.
Uneventful days, uneventful nights, living in the dark, waiting for the light. Caught up in these never-ending battle lines, everything has changed, nothing it feels right. No, I know, I know, I know, and oh, I know it's gone. And oh, 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 no, I know it's gone, yeah. Never-ending days, never-ending nights, everything I say, can't get right. Name it definitely, mourn me that life. You might know my name, you don't.